Shade from New Jersey. It's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out over Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Lewis Winthorpe III.
And I'm your co-host, Billy Ray Valentine.
How you doing, Billy Ray?
Feeling good, Lewis.
Yeah.
Right off the bat.
Yeah. Woo. So, as you might have guessed from that intro, we are doing, for this week's SNL movie,
Yes. We're
doing 1983's Trading Places, starring Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy.
Yes, one Edward Murphy, my comedy messiah.
Yeah.
What?
Your comedy messiah?
I would say so. Like, I make no bones about it. Like, I got into stand-up comedy, I mean, both doing it and just being a fan of it through Eddie Murphy. Like, once I saw Eddie Murphy on SNL and all his sketches, I was like, oh, mm-hmm. This guy's really funny. Then I saw his stand-up. I was like, whoa, this guy is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then through him, I was like, oh, stand-up comedy seems cool. Let me get into other comedians. And that's how I just got into all stand-up comedy and whatnot. So he was the nucleus of my comedy
world.
So
if it wasn't for Eddie Murphy, you might not be doing this podcast with me right now.
That's right. I don't know what I'd be successful somewhere. Or
just be a drifter.
Yeah, just walking the... Yeah, just
you'd be on a cart pretending you don't have legs, just begging for change in the streets.
No. I was going to say, just be like walking the earth like Kane and Kung Fu. But
well, sure.
I like that because that segues into the movie.
That does. That
way
does.
Better.
So this is interesting because it's a team up between two very notable SNL cast members.
Yeah.
One from the original cast, Mr. Dan Aykroyd, and one from the guy. He came on... What year did Eddie Murphy come on? Like 1980, ooh. 81?
Yeah.
Early 80s, anyway.
Yeah, early aughts. Not early aughts. Early 80s.
Yeah.
Not early aughts. But Trading Places came out on June 8th, 1983, directed by John Landis. This is the third John Landis movie we've talked about.
We did Animal House, Blues Brothers, the fourth.
Fourth?
We did Blues Brothers 2000.
Oh, that's right.
Landis did that one, too.
Man, so John Landis is all over this podcast.
We are covering the heck out of John Landis's filmography here.
Yeah, yeah. And this movie was written by Timothy Harris and Herschel Weingrod, who went on to write Brewster's Millions, Twins, Kindergarten Cop, My Stepmother's an Alien, and Space Jam.
Wow. That's a pretty good screenwriting career there.
Pretty hefty resume.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. This movie had a budget of 15 mil, made 90. So.
Did well.
Yeah, that's right. Pork bellies.
And that's 1983 dollars. So
You could buy all the boom boxes you want with that money.
That's right. That's right. You could go serenade Ione Sky all you wanted.
Yeah, in your eyes.
That's right.
The light, the heat.
So let me read the back of the DVD that we watched with the little summary. We've got the headline, Going for Broke. What happens when you combine the comic genius of Eddie Murphy, Norbit, Dreamgirls? So that gives it...
Norbit?
Well, that gives you a little insight into when this DVD came out.
What? All right.
There was also a trailer for Norbit on this DVD.
Oh.
When you team up the comic genius of Eddie Murphy and with Dan Aykroyd, Ghostbusters, Christmas with the Cranks.
Are they all on the same label, I guess?
I don't know.
Because who put out this movie? Like Paramount or something?
Yes, it was Paramount.
So maybe they're all Paramount movies, I guess.
Maybe. Yeah. Well, I think it was just like their recent credits, and it's another movie where he teams with Jamie Lee Curtis, so...
Christmas
with the Cranks, yeah. And director John Landis, Animal House, Coming to America. You get a timeless comedy classic laced with side-splitting satiric humor. Murphy stars as a small-time con artist who gets a chance to switch lives with Aykroyd's big-time stock market maven. But their reversal of fortunes is just a cruel joke perpetuated by two bored mega-rich brothers, Don Amici and Ralph Bellamy, as part of an idle bet. And when the truth comes out, the consequences are sheer comedy gold. So
yeah, that's pretty much it. It's
not the best summary, but
the best, but it's enough to drag you in and get you to buy the DVD.
I guess so. You know, it's like, ooh, the guys who behind Norbit and Christmas with the Cranks did this. Well,
you have my money, sir. I mean, it's been a while since I've seen this movie. Like, I mean, it came out in 83, and this is one of those movies that you always just came on. Like Channel 11 or Channel 9 on a Sunday afternoon, and like I'd see clips of it here and there, but I haven't like sat down and watched it, the unrated version, all the way through.
From beginning to end.
From beginning to quite a bit. And I got to say, this movie holds up. I really dug it.
It is funny. It's an enjoyable movie. I enjoyed watching it and revisiting it.
Yeah.
This was a movie, I don't believe I saw this in the theater. I was still, because it's a rated R movie. It was 83. I would have been like 10 or 11 when it came out.
Right. So, you didn't sneak into R-rated movie at that age.
I did not.
That's right. Because you're a good boy.
I was a good boy. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sure I saw it either on cable or at a friend's house or something like that.
Once HBO came out and you'd, like, your parents went to sleep and you'd watch and see boobs.
Well, I mean, I didn't have HBO at home as a kid, so HBO would be a thing I would see like when I was visiting my dad like twice a year because he had HBO. So HBO was like a very special treat.
Yeah. Oh, he had the hookup.
But I would stay up late in hopes of seeing boobs.
Yeah. And
this movie does not disappoint in that
regard.
That's right.
This movie fulfills all your boob needs.
I mean, I don't know if all my boob needs, but many of my boob needs.
Well, most of them.
I mean, I have many and sundry boob needs. I mean, I'll send you a link to my manifesto later on.
Oh, boy.
But we were saying, like, before we started recording, it is funny, like, because this is really a look into a different world of movie making, like the movie making of the early 80s, where you just had those gratuitous boob shots.
Yeah, very much so.
It's not like a full-blown sex scene or anything. No. It's just like some women just happen to take their tops off.
Yeah, there's no need, no call for it, no need for it. Doesn't add to the story at all.
No.
Doesn't push along the plot. It's just like, hey, guys, you like boobs?
Yeah.
Yeah, you go.
Here's some 2 seconds of boobs. Enjoy.
Have at it.
And that was it for, that was what you got in 1983.
Yeah, and that made you $90 million. God bless America.
So there's some interesting backstory behind this movie. It was originally conceived as a vehicle for Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, who were like really hot at the time.
I could see that.
So yeah, I could see that too. I could definitely see Richard Pryor as in the Eddie Murphy part as Billy Ray Valentine.
Yeah, of course.
Gene Wilder, I don't know. I'm sure he would have played the part completely differently from how Dan Aykroyd did it.
How do you think he would have played?
I don't know. I mean, Gene Wilder's just a very unique guy.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I just don't see him doing the same type of thing.
Same type of waspy thing.
Yeah, I can't point to something and say like, oh, that's how Gene Wilder would have done it. I just know that I think that it would have been substantially different.
Okay. But they turned it down and then they went with Aykroyd.
Pryor dropped out and then they brought Eddie Murphy on board because he had a big hit of 48 Hours.
Oh, yeah, this is Eddie Murphy's second movie.
Literally his second movie, and his first 48 Hours. So, yeah, pretty good.
Not too shabby.
There was a neat thing with Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy. I'm going to try and find that.
Okay.
There's a lot of trivia about this on the IMDb page, so I'm scrolling down to try and find that. But it was about the number of movies that they did. It was something like, I think Don Ameche had done 49 movies,
ooh,
and Ralph Bellamy had done like 110 movies.
Oh my God.
And Eddie Murphy said, well, among the three of us, we've done 150 movies. So
the numbers add up. Numbers don't lie.
This is very cute. That was very cute. And they Ralph Bellamy was the first choice for the Duke brother that he played.
Okay.
But they wanted someone else for the other Duke brother.
For,
they wanted
Mortimer. Who did?
Right. They wanted what's his name from? God, I'm blanking on names. They wanted the guy who was in Miracle on 34th Street.
Oh,
the guy who played the lawyer.
Oh,
Yep.
Get a job. All right, now I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, crap.
Okay, Frank, feel free to chop this up as you see fit.
Yeah, no, this is a freaking mess so far, quite honestly. But
okay, all right. Well, here let's go in and describe the movie a bit while you look up that important information. All right, so the movie takes place in Philadelphia.
Which I'd forgotten. I was remembering it as taking place in New York because it deals with all the New York finances.
Right.
And at the climax, they go to the World Trade Center to trade on the floor.
Yeah, that is true. But, I mean, I guess anytime you see a movie taking place in a city, you just kind of automatically assume it's New York City. But no, it takes place in... They show the Rocky statue.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
Not more Philly than that.
It is very Philly.
Yeah. Oh, and the Liberty Bell, too. But I think the Rocky statue is more Philly. Anyway, it focuses on the Duke brothers, Mortimer and Randolph, played by Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy, and they own a commodities brokerage firm, because they're a commodities broker, and they basically...
Now, what are commodities?
Can
you explain commodities?
It's like this... they had a scene of this in a movie.
Yeah, like, I was trying to lead you up to
it's
it.
It's like orange juice, and I kind of zoned out.
There's like frozen orange juice concentrate.
Yeah, pork bellies.
Pork bellies.
Wheat.
Wheat.
Agriculture type of things.
Okay.
And this is why I'm broke.
Bellies,
I don't
they make bacon, which you might find on a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich.
Right. And then anywhere if you look in the camera.
Yeah.
I was like, we'll talk about that part later.
Okay.
But yeah. So they're commodities brokers, and Lewis Winthorpe, played by Dan Aykroyd, he works for them.
Ray Milland! That's the guy I was trying to think of.
Whoa.
Ray Milland! They wanted Ray Milland to play the other Duke brother, but he wasn't cleared by insurance, so they got Don Ameche.
Wow, my headphones just kind of blew off my head.
I'm sorry. The name just popped into my head, and I was very, very excited.
My headphones were like,
Because there's a little bit of trivia that I wanted
to share. Okay, Ray Milland?
Ray Milland.
All right.
Yeah. You would know him if you saw him.
Okay, I'm sure I would.
Yeah.
All right, so the Duke brothers, they own a commodities brokerage firm. They're extremely wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Lewis, Dan Aykroyd's character, works for them. He's a commodities broker. He lives in a house that they own.
What's the deal with that?
What? I
don't get why that is like that outside of just plot convenience.
I don't know. I just
work for somebody and you work or you live in a house that they own.
Yeah, I just shrugged it off. I was like, all right, I'll suspend this belief. I mean, I assume just because Lewis is also very good at his job, and he's made them tons of money, so they just put him up in a house, like a comedy.
Yeah, and he's also
condo.
He's also engaged to their grandniece.
Yeah,
Penelope. So,
who I think she's a model. Like in real life,
she was a model, and she only did like two movies after this, which I found fascinating. She did two movies total. Okay. Let me get the cast list up.
So after she just said the two movies and said goodbye to the game?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
Pretty much. Oh, I think. Wow. I guess she just preferred modeling.
All right. Oh, and also Lewis has a butler by his side, played by Denholm Elliott. Yeah.
Yeah.
Coleman.
Yeah.
And yeah, so
who you might remember Denholm Elliott from as Marcus in the Indiana Jones movie. That's probably what he's best known for.
Absolutely.
Marcus Brody.
Yeah, so like Lewis is a very kind of waspy, you know, kind of blue blood, highfalutin man. Like a Greg Marmalade.
Mm-hmm. He totally would have been an Omega.
He's a huge Greg Marmalade.
Yeah.
But he works for the Duke brothers. He's very good at his job. He makes him tons of money. And then they also look at Eddie Murphy, who plays Billy Ray Valentine, who is kind of wheeling around the streets of Philly, pretending to be a legless, blind vet.
Yeah.
But of course he's
a street hustler.
Yeah, street
well, not,
hustler.
Well, not a street hustler and a man whore, but...
Yeah. he's not a gigolo.
No. He's a con man.
Yeah, exactly. So. And he hits on women. It's like, hey, baby, come on, me and you. I got no legs and you. You ever see Porgy and Bess?
Yeah.
He said that joke. I was like, oh, do I have to read Porgy and Bess now to get that joke?
I had on the trivia track when I was watching the movie, and it explained that Porgy and Bess, it is about like an amputee, and it's a love story.
All right.
Well, and there was a movie with Sidney Poitier.
Oh, nice. Okay. I can see it. So anyway, the Duke brothers one day go into work, and they're having this big debate about nature versus nurture.
Right.
Like,
yeah, like they're like, hey, Lewis is a fine young man, isn't he? And it's like, well, you know, it's because he has this great background and he went to all the best schools and all this. And Don Ameche's Duke brother says, no, it's because of breeding. It's because he's from good stock.
Yeah, he's bred to do this.
He's inherently superior.
Exactly.
And they decide to make a wager on this.
Yeah, so like basically the whole... Oh, and also there's a mention where... Lewis is looking through the books, and he sees that there's somebody on the payroll named Clarence Beeks.
Clarence Beeks.
Which comes into play later.
That does. And Aykroyd and Murphy have this encounter where they literally bump into each other on the street. Aykroyd drops his briefcase. Aykroyd immediately assumes that Eddie Murphy is robbing him.
Right, because he's a poor black man.
Sure.
That's what they do.
He's dressed like a street person, and I mean... So it the chase ensues.
Yeah, there's a big old Benny Hill chase that Eddie Murphy runs into the commodities offices, and like everybody sees him, and of course the cops come in, they bust Eddie. He's like, "No, I was trying to give him back his suitcase. Didn't do anything." And then of course Wynn's just like, "Arrest that man, send him away." He's all like hoity-toity.
Right.
And so then the Duke brothers see this and they say, "All right, well, you know, that street hustler guy, you know, he comes from a broken home, of course."
Right.
And so, like, maybe we could switch their lives and settle this bet. Like,
right. Would Billy Ray Valentine be as good at his job as Aykroyd is?
Right.
And I'm switching between the actors and the character names now.
You get it.
And would Aykroyd's character be driven to crime if we take everything away from him? We take away his job, his fiance, his home,
his friends, and...
And
yeah, so they're basically messing with two people's lives for a bet.
Yes.
Which is pretty fucked up.
they are not good characters.
No, not at all.
The Dukes are not good characters. And I was like surprised by a couple things of like how not good characters they are.
They're screwing over their granddaughter, the fiance of their granddaughters, of grandnieces.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that is, ugh.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is a line of dialogue that I made note of. One of them says, "Of course, there's something wrong with him. He's a Negro." So right there,
yeah.
That's kind of your cue. Not good guys, the Duke brothers.
Mortimer's racist, and there's just no way around it.
I would say they're both racist.
They're both all right.
Yeah,
Randolph's not woke. All right, I'll give you that. But yeah, it is. Right off the bat, you know these dudes are just garbage.
Yeah.
So they plan on doing this. They plan on switching these people's lives and taking everything away from Lewis, giving everything to Billy Ray, and see what happens. So
and they put this together in like a day.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive.
Yeah. I mean, they call Coleman, the butler.
Yeah.
So Coleman's already in on it. He's like, okay.
He reluctantly goes along with this plan.
Right. I mean, because they mentioned that, like, you know, Lewis doesn't pay Coleman. The Duke brothers pay Coleman.
Right, because you always have your personal butler paid by for other people.
Just roll with it, man.
Again, it's a weird thing for plot convenience.
Let it go, man.
Yeah.
So anyway, so then they show Billy Ray in prison, you know, being held by the cops. And you also see a young Giancarlo Esposito in that scene.
Yeah, yeah, Esposito.
Like, oh, Gus Fring, look at him doing his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was cool. And Eddie's like improvising up a storm, talking about, you know, he's a karate expert, and he bruises on the inside. And
yeah.
Yeah, and
They just let Eddie Murphy go and do what he does.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it looks like there's these two big dudes that look like they're about to beat him up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one says, "Yeah, I'm going to fuck you up." And the other guys go, "Yeah." All he says is, "Yeah."
Yeah.
And of course, before they get to beat him up, Billy Ray gets bailed out by the Duke brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's very hesitant about all this, but the Duke brothers invite him into their limo. And they say, you know, we like to sort of reach out to, you know, underprivileged people like yourself. So we want to hook you up with a job and, you know, money and like a house and everything. Mm-hmm.
And they lure him into their limo by going, "We have whiskey, all you want."
Yeah.
Just, okay.
You're black, you like liquor, right? Huh?
You're a street person.
Yeah, again, not woke.
So they bring him over to Lewis Winthorpe's house.
Lewis's house, which they say is now his house.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they install Billy Ray there before they officially throw Lewis out.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lewis was at work when they did that.
Yeah, it's just, you'd think they would do it the other way around just for...
Yeah, you think, because, like, oh, you could just come home any minute. But,
exactly.
I don't know. I guess they worked it out. But
yeah, rule of funny, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So then they told, you know, this is all yours. Billy Ray gets into a bathtub and
a jacuzzi.
He's like, "Oh, this is cool, man." Like,
yeah,
back in my day, you had to get bubbles, you had to fart in the bathtub.
Right, right.
It's bad, man. It's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And of course, like, Billy Ray is very, he's very wary of all this. He actually asks the black limo driver as they drive up, like, am I being played, bro? Is this some type of joke?
Uh-huh.
And he's like, no. It's like, oh, these guys, some type, and he drops an F-bomb.
Yeah,
these
guys,
gay or something.
Early 80s.
Early 80s. So yeah, so then they do everything they can to convince him that this is his house now. He can wear all the nice clothes mm-hmm. he wants, and he works for them.
I really like the scene where the Duke brothers are trying to convince him, like, no, this is really all your stuff. And Eddie Murphy is just going around, and he's like palming stuff around the room, just
yeah.
like swiping stuff. That was very funny.
Yeah, and there was one point where like Coleman has Billy Ray's old clothes, and he said, well, what should I do? He asked the Duke's brother, what should I do with his old clothes?
Right.
And he said, hold on to them. You'll need to wear them once we put them back in the ghetto.
Right.
And I was like, God damn.
That's harsh. It is harsh.
It is harsh. So then while that's going on, they go ahead and frame Lewis for
stealing at the club. They bring in Clarence Beeks, who's the yeah. security guy.
Played by Paul Gleason.
Paul Gleason, who you probably remember as the principal from The Breakfast Club.
Yeah, it's also...
And Die Hard.
And Die Hard, he was author.
If you needed an asshole in the 80s, Paul Gleason was one of the guys yeah. that you went right. to play that asshole.
If William Atherton was busy, you go to Paul Gleason.
Right. That's and if it. You get both William Atherton and Paul Gleason together, oh my God, you just made Die Hard.
Yes, that's right.
So, but yeah, and Paul Gleason is wonderful. By the way, did you see who they originally wanted for this role?
No, who?
They originally wanted G. Gordon Liddy.
Really?
G. Gordon Liddy, mastermind of the Watergate break-in. They went so far as to like approach him for the role, but G. Gordon Liddy, when he saw what ended up happening to the character of Clarence Beeks at the end of the movie,
which we will get to, that
he was like, "No, I don't really want to play this."
what you I don't do get... want to get?
Yeah.
we'll talk about it later.
He gets raped by a gorilla, you guys. All right,
yeah. He gets piped up. He gets piped down by a monkey.
Yeah. butt sex. Very, very random ending for that character.
Yeah, that part, I'll talk about that part. Like,
But towards the end of the movie, you see Paul Gleason, he's reading G. Gordon Liddy's biography, Will. That's sort of like a reference to what they wanted.
Oh,
apparently after Landis met with G. Gordon Liddy, he was like, I don't want to cast this guy. Anyway, but G. Gordon
Liddy. I mean, why
was
he
like,
in the mix to begin with? He's not an actor, really.
No, but I can see the humor in it, and you know, Landis has done some offbeat casting in the past.
I guess
like
so.
There was resistance to him casting Jamie Lee Curtis in this movie because
really?
She was at the time only thought of as like a screen queen because she'd done like the Halloween movies and not too much else, and she'd never really done comedy before. But Landis had met her. Like a one-day shoot for some Universal thing. Mm. And he was like, yeah, she can do this. She would be good at this. And he went to bat for her, and it changed her whole career.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
So, yeah.
Not bad.
So, tip of the hat to Mr. John Landis there.
Oh, good for you, Mr. Landis. All right. All right, so back to the movie. So, we have Beeks. He planted some money and... You know, a few other things on Lewis.
Right.
Of course, he frames him, he fingers him, and everybody asks him to, like, he basically does it in front of everybody, in front of the whole
firm.
Yeah,
he frames him in front of all this and makes it look like that Aykroyd, like, stole some $50 bills with X's on them.
Right.
And then they take him to the police station. They plant drugs on him. They plant PCP on him.
Exactly.
And so when Frank Oz is like going through his belongings, he finds...
Right. Frank Oz, he plays one of the cops, and he's in on it with Beeks.
Yeah.
And he kind of does... He kind of reprises his role as the same thing he did in The Blues Brothers, where he like lists off the items that Aykroyd has in his pocket.
He has apparently relocated from Chicago to Philadelphia to do this, to specialize in,
he's
doing inventories on people's possessions.
He's been promoted.
And then we know from Blues Brothers 2000 that he's like now warden of that prison. So,
that's right, of course.
So we can follow his whole career trajectory through the course of John Landis's movies.
A lot of lateral moves.
Yeah, yeah.
They find PCP on him, and then they lock him up in the hoosegow.
Yes, yeah. And I like how later in the movie where Aykroyd's like former friends, they're saying like, oh, you're dealing heroin, and Aykroyd always corrects him. He's like, no, it wasn't heroin, it was PCP. I love that he's that anal that he has to correct them. No, it was this illicit drug, not this illicit drug.
So, you know, don't put me in the same category as those folks.
Right.
This is just PCP, harmless stuff.
That I found very funny, and that was a joke that I forgot about. Now, meanwhile, Billy Ray Valentine, he's living the high life with all of Winthorpe's money.
Yeah,
and throwing a big party.
Yeah, yeah. He goes to a dive bar where there's like tons of, you know, just people, like people he knew from the streets. There were a couple of
ladies of the evening,
mm-hmm. ladies of ill repute, mm-hmm. and a couple of pimps in there too. And he invites everybody to his place for a party, and then of course they, you know, it gets wild, and mm-hmm. you know, women's tops comes off, you know,
yep.
boobies abound.
Been waiting for you, Billy Ray.
Yeah,
he goes up to his bedroom. There's just like this woman with her bazooms all out,
bazoom,
and that's
That's a good one. I haven't heard that one in a minute.
And
But then Billy Ray gets very protective of his place now. He's like, hey, what's up? It's like, you know, use coasters on here. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, who's been putting cools out on my floor?
Right.
I was like, cools? Oh, damn.
Yeah, I read on the trivia track, it said that they originally axed that line because they thought it was, you know, it might come off as racist, but Eddie Murphy put it back in.
Oh, gotcha.
So.
It got the Eddie Murphy okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
If Eddie Murphy approves it, it's not racist. That's exactly. The rule, right?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
That rule apparently was in full effect at the end of this movie.
Yeah, ooh, was it ever.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, so so then Eddie Murphy gets upset, kicks everybody out, and just goes.
And I should mention this, we have a little cameo at the end of this party. One of the partygoers who's leaving, you see Denim Elliott helping her on with her fur coat,
right.
And she says, thank you. It's this blonde woman in a blue top.
Yeah, who is that?
Showing a lot of cleavage. That is Arlene Sorkin, who is best known as the voice of Harley Quinn.
Huh.
And I read an interview with her once where she talked about how she ended up in this movie. She did like a lot of extra work as when she was like this young actress, and she had these boots that I think she called like hooker boots.
Right.
So she got like a lot of parts as like hookers and party girls and stuff because they looked like the type of boots a hooker might wear. And she said, like, you've seen me leaning into cars in a lot of various movies.
Gotcha.
And she was, like, dressed this day. And apparently John Landis saw her and was like, I've got to do something with that cleavage. And so he put her in this scene and gave her a line. So there is a moment in Trading Places where you see Arlene Sorkin having her coat helped on by Denim Elliott. And she says, thank you. So I was keeping an eye out for her, and I was like, I don't think I've spotted her. And then she pops up.
There.
So I was very...
I got to do something with them knockers.
Yeah.
That's my John Landis impression.
Yeah.
Pretty spot on.
Yeah, spot on. Spot on.
Like, achihuahua, them knockers. I got to do something.
So while Eddie is growing disenchanted with the high life,
right.
We follow Dan Aykroyd, and he gets
bailed out by his fiancé.
By his fiancé. Penelope, who was played by Kristen Holby. She did this movie, and then she did the movie Manhunter in 1986, and that was it. That was all she wrote.
Interesting. And we see Lewis has been kind of beaten up. He has like a black eye and a bloody lip. So something happened when he was locked up.
Yeah,
and, you know, of course his fiance Penelope, she seems more mortified that he would do all these things rather than concerned for him.
Well, and he almost has her convinced that he is not guilty of any of this stuff, and that is some horrible setup or misunderstanding.
It's like those men wanted to have sex with me,
and then
like he almost got raped in prison. I guess.
Yeah, and then it was 83, prison rape was still
it was all the rage.
Yeah, that's right. just as he's about convinced his fiance Penelope that this is some horrible mistake, Jamie Lee Curtis's character comes up. She is a prostitute by the name of Ophelia.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, daddy, I need some more stuff. I'm really jonesing for it. Right. And that seals the deal. And Penelope is like, I am done with you. Yeah. Oh, no.
I am out of here. Yeah. But we see that Ophelia was paid off by Beaks because Ophelia was about to, you know, she's a woman of the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And she just got out of prison. And then Beaks saw her and be like, hey, you want to make a quick 100? Go up to that guy and pretend to, you know, make out with him, pretending he's your drug dealer.
It's a joke.
hilarious, right?
Yeah, she's like, oh, your friend said it would get you off.
So,
very specific kink there, but I guess Ophelia's seen a lot of stuff in her line of work.
People like different things.
So Aykroyd's screwed, and he Ophelia takes sympathy on him, and then they take a cab back to her place. She agrees to, like...
Well, no, she they first they take a cab back to Lewis's house, his apartment.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's like I'll give you the money to get home, or
right,
you know,
right.
Once I just get home and get my affairs in order. But of course, they get to his home. Coleman has the chain on the door, mm-hmm. like an apartment building for some reason. He looks at him. He's like, oh, he looks right at Lewis and says, "I have no idea who you are.
Yeah.
Like, please leave, or
Coleman here."
Yeah,
and he just pretends he's never seen him before.
Yeah, please leave, or I'll call the cops.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he's like, this must be some mistake. He goes to the bank to try to get out money. He found that the IRS has frozen his accounts.
Yeah.
And they're ordered to, like, destroy all his credit cards, so he has absolutely no money.
Nope.
And he's just, like, just destitute now. He doesn't understand what is happening to him.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on. But, like you said, Ophelia takes pity on him and says, all right, you can come and crash at my place so you get yourself sorted out.
Right.
So, yeah. And then they go to Ophelia's apartment and... You know, she says, like, look, she basically gives her a backstory a little bit, saying...
Yeah, we find out that she is not just a prostitute. She's also very financially savvy. She's got, like, a lot of money in T-bills, and she's saving up, and she's right. like, I figure I've got, like, 3 more years on my back, and then I can, like, retire
right.
for the rest of my life.
Exactly.
So she's like, financially savvy. She's got investments and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. So she kind of believes Lewis saying, like, I'll take care of you, just get back on your feet, and then... But... Like, once you do get back on your feet, you look out for me and, pay me with interest.
Yeah.
And then say, okay.
Yeah.
So then
that happens all the time.
Yeah, people take in strangers all the time.
You are down on your luck. You will find a kind-hearted prostitute who will take you in and let you stay in her apartment. A prostitute without a pimp, by the way.
Yeah, she's like freelance. I guess they do that? I don't know.
I guess that's a thing. I don't know. I would think that would be a rather rare thing.
Yeah, just a freelance prostitute. I
guess she decided herself, like, I am going to become a prostitute. She outright says, like, oh, this is one of my assets.
Yeah.
Like, my assets are, like, this body.
My face.
My face and my brain.
Yeah.
And so she apparently in that order.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. I mean, she knows the score, so that's something. So then after that, they go back and they show what Billy Ray's doing, and he goes into work, and it's basically the Duke brothers explaining commodities to him. But as they're explaining it to him, you can tell they're explaining it to us, the viewers, at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. We, the viewers, are stupid, and we do not know how commodities trading works.
Yeah. I have no idea. Because there's actually at one point where they're explaining it to him, and like Billy Ray breaks the fourth wall and looks right into the camera.
Yeah.
As to say, you know, this is...
I mean, John Landis likes doing that, because he has that moment in Animal House where Belushi turns to the camera.
When he's on the ladder.
Yeah. I can't remember if there was a breaking the fourth wall moment in Blues Brothers or not, but I feel like there probably was.
There probably was. I don't remember it.
Yeah. But...
But yeah, so they basically break down commodities and what they do. You know, kind of like the Big Short style, like that movie Big Short. But then what happened, after they explain it, they say, oh, so do you understand now? And then Billy Ray says, oh, yeah, it sounds like you guys are just basically a couple of bookies.
Yeah.
And, like, that was a hilarious line, because, like, after he said that, then I got, like, oh, okay, but they're bookies.
Right, yeah, because they explain how, like, they make these investments for their clients, but they make a commission whether their clients...
Win or lose
money. Yeah. So he's like, yeah, you guys are bookies.
And he's like, yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
After he said that, he's like, oh, now I got it. All right,
yeah, exactly. They dumbed it down enough for us, the poor dumb audience.
They're fancy bookies. That's all they are, fancy bookies.
Fancy. And it turns out that Billy Ray is very good at this. He's got an intuitive understanding of this, and he makes the Duke brothers some money by reading... what's going on in the market, or what's going on kind of behind the market. He's like, well, hey, Christmas is coming up. People are nervous. You know, they're panicky. We're not going to be panicky. We're going to.
Yeah.
And they make a few grand just from Billy Ray. So,
as it happens, it seems like Billy Ray is changing a little bit. Like, they call him William instead of Billy. And like he's cursing less and he's actually kind of turning into like a version of Lewis in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like changing, which is like, oh, I thought that was an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Lewis is spiraling. We have him. He hits rock bottom when he's like, he shows up at the Christmas party in a Santa suit.
Yeah, well, I mean, he does go to the, well, first he goes to the country club trying to ask his friends for money, and of course they all shun him.
Yeah.
And it looks like his...
Go away, Lewis. No one wants to buy your drugs here.
Yeah. And then it looks like Penelope is shacked up with Todd, some other dude.
Yeah, Todd moved in quick.
Todd was just
happened over the course of like 2 days.
Yeah.
This movie has a very tight timeline. Yeah. This movie takes place over like... I think a week or maybe a week and a half.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because it's like it's the lead up to Christmas and then it ends like on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, Todd was like waiting in the wings like a snake.
Yeah.
And so, so then he gets shunned by all his friends. Mm-hmm. No one will lend him money. And yeah. So then after that, he tries to hawk his watch. And the guy in the pawn shop is Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
I was like, why is Bo Diddley here?
I guess John Landis was like, hey, I didn't get Bo Diddley into Blues Brothers, so let's get him into Trading Places.
I guess so. I guess that must be it.
I don't know.
So, Bo Diddley sees the watch. It's worth a lot, but he's like, oh, no, this is hot. I'll give you 50 mm-hmm. bucks for it, and that's it.
Yeah.
And, of course, Lewis just gets further and further into despair. At one point, he's walking by a restaurant in the rain, of course, mm-hmm. and he sees Billy Ray with his other broker friends, like talking, talking business and whatnot, and he sees the life that he had, and I don't think Billy Ray saw him, but he was just like,
he's not aware. But there is a moment where they like pass each other in a vehicle, like Billy Ray's in Lewis's old limo with Coleman driving, and then Ackroyd's in the back of a cab with Ophelia. And he's like, well...
And Coleman pretends not to see. He's like, oh, I don't know who you're talking about. So.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, and also, when Lewis is in the pawn shop with Bo Diddley, he asks, oh, how much is that gun?
So yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That comes into play later.
Yeah,
so
Lewis goes to the Duke Brothers Christmas party as a Santa, and he's the most... horrible...
Yeah, where did he get...
Awful-looking Santa.
It's like a Santa suit out of the trash. He was like... Covered in grime and whatnot.
Trash. Yeah, he's drinking quite a bit and he's stealing stuff from the buffet. He puts an entire salmon in his Santa suit.
As you do. Of course.
And then he makes his way into Billy Ray's office. Used to be his office, presumably. Right. And he plants drugs in there.
Yeah.
And then when the Duke brothers come in, they see what Lewis has fallen to. And I love the script here where he like pulls out the drawer and he's like, look, he's got all the bad drugs here. Marijuana joints, pills, Quaaludes, yellows, reds, Valium, a cocaine grinder, and drug needles. And I love that all the terminology is just a little off. It just shows how unfamiliar.
A cocaine grinder?
A cocaine grinder? Marijuana joints?
Marijuana
drug needles? It was wonderful. I don't know. I'm assuming that was in the script, but that was hilarious.
Yeah, it was a good line. So, and then after that, I think they call the cops, or they were going to call security, but then that's when Ackroyd, Lewis pulled out a gun and
kind
of makes his way
out.
He
makes his escape.
Exactly, just like dejected
and
drunk.
This is around the time that Eddie Murphy's character, he starts to suspect, I don't think this is all kosher. There's something going on here.
Right.
And we see him actually steal one of the joints.
Yeah, I thought that was hilarious.
And he goes into the men's room to smoke it, which I'd forgotten.
Smoke a dube.
And he's in one of the stalls, and then the Duke brothers come in.
Yeah.
And they've now seen enough that they pay off the bet.
Right.
So it's... which brother was it that I forget which brother bet which way, but
I think Randolph was nature, and then I think Mortimer was nurture.
Okay,
so I think Mortimer had to pay Randolph a dollar. So mm-hmm. then it's like, all right, so now the bet's off. So now what do we do?
And we find out that the amount of the bet was a dollar. They ruined these men's lives for a dollar. They are garbage people. And they discuss the possibility, hey, maybe we should just let, Billy Ray stay. He's doing pretty well for us. And
that's when
the other brother says, do you really think I'd let our...
He drops an N-bomb with a hard R.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Do you think I'd let our family business in the hands of a...
Yeah.
A little...
I was like,
right,
God damn.
So...
And then, of course, they say, well, maybe should we bring in Winthrop, bring back Lewis? It's like, no, after what he did, I'm not bringing him back. So,
right.
So now that the bet's over, they want to get rid of both the guys.
Right.
And, of course, Billy Ray overhears all of this, and he's like, oh, snap.
Yeah.
And, of course, he runs down trying to find Lewis, but Lewis is I think at this point he's like drunk and he's like very depressed and he gets on a bus, goes back to.
He's about to commit suicide. He puts a gun to his head and he pulls the trigger and then it just clicks and then he throws the gun away and then you hear the gun go off
and shoot something else.
Yeah.
A dog pees on his leg and he's just like, he goes into Ophelia's apartment and he just goes to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Ray tracks him down to the apartment and he sees the door's open. He's like, does Lewis Winthrop live here?
Yeah.
And then
Ophelia recognizes Billy Ray.
Right.
And then that's when they get together and then they figure out what's going on.
Right. And then they say, oh, yeah, Billy Ray's in the bathroom. And then they go into the bathroom and they see, Lewis in the bathroom. They go into the bathroom with Lewis and they see that he's like OD'd on pills trying to commit suicide in the
tub. Right.
So after that, then they bring Lewis to Billy Ray's place, which was Lewis's place, and then they
and Coleman helps him out.
Coleman helps him out. They get Lewis back on his feet, and they explain what's going
on. And Lewis wakes up in his own bed, and he's like well dressed. He's in like some nice pajamas and something. And he's like, "Oh, I just had a horrible dream. And I dreamt that I lost everything, and it was all the fault of this horrible Negro.
This horrible Negro. They really just say black. Why do you guys say Negro?
I kind of loved that because it was just.
Yeah.
It was so.
I mean, it's funnier to say Negro. I get it. It's funnier.
I mean, Negro's
funnier.
It was funnier that he's using this very outdated term, and and it just shows how upper crust and out of touch he is.
Yeah.
And
this horrible Negro.
It was all the fault of this horrible Negro.
Good heavens. It's
so wrong, but I mean, it's.
Yeah.
John Landis, as a director, he knows when to throw out the word Negro.
He does. It was
all the fault of this horrible Negro. The Negro took our dates.
He loves using the Negro term.
It's used effectively. It can be very, very funny.
It can be used for good as well as evil.
But
everybody is in on what the Duke brothers did to them. Of course, they want.
They hatch a scheme.
Yeah. I think at first Lewis wants to just shoot them with rifles.
Oh, I should backtrack a minute. Like when Aykroyd wakes up and he sees that Eddie Murphy is there, there's a very funny bit where he like grabs Eddie by the throat and he's like strangling him. And you hear Eddie just going, "It wasn't me. It was my dude, brother." And it was, the voice is just hilarious. It was one of the funniest moments in the movie.
It's like when Homer chokes out Bart.
Yeah.
It was like that type of thing.
It was in that very exaggerated, cartoony John Landis sort of style. But very, very funny.
Right. So then they figure out the Duke brothers or what they'd done to them. So they want revenge. Billy Ray figured that, the best revenge is to make, rich people poor. See what it did to you.
Right. And when they're watching TV, they see a report about the upcoming orange crop report, which is very vital to the Duke brothers because they deal with frozen orange juice concentrate. And then they spot on the TV Clarence Beeks, the guy who helped set all this nastiness up.
Yeah, basically the Duke brothers' goon or go-to guy.
Yeah, yeah. He's like their dirty tricks guy, like G. Gordon Liddy.
Yes. Ooh, wow.
And
getting political.
Yeah, and so Ophelia recognizes him and she's like, "Hey, that's the guy that then they hear the name Clarence Beeks," and both Billy Ray and Lewis had seen payments for Clarence Beeks.
Right.
And the Duke's brothers, and they both had asked about, "Hey, what's the deal with this guy?" And the Duke brothers were both like, "Oh no, don't worry about him."
Just wave it off like, "Oh, he's just doing something." So basically Clarence Beeks has been doing this with the Duke brothers for years.
They put it all together.
Yeah, like he's just been giving them reports before they've been made public, and off those reports, the Duke brothers have been able to, do their commodities thing and just make millions.
It's insider trading, basically.
Yes.
They're getting this information illegally.
Yes.
So that they can have an unfair advantage on the trading floor.
Right. So they figure, if we get to Beeks before he gets to the Dukes, get that, that crop report, and swap it out with a fake crop report, we can like take all their money and get over on them.
Right.
So they put this plan in motion to meet up with Beeks on their train because he's going on a train from D.C. to Philly, I believe.
Was it D.C.?
I'm pretty sure he mentioned D.C. in there.
Okay.
It was a Philly bound train. It was going to Philadelphia.
So. Actually, shot at a train station in New Jersey, according to the trivia.
Hey, New Jersey, Jersey strong.
Yay!
Nice. So
I have no idea which station, but it looked like New Jersey Transit.
Yeah, it looked dirty. But I say that with love. I keep. So they're Clarence Beek just gets on this Amtrak going to Philly, and apparently there's like some big New Year's Eve party happening on that train.
Big costume ball bazaar.
We see Jim Belushi in a gorilla outfit.
Maintaining our Belushi through line through these last few weeks.
Absolutely. And also, there's also these two baggage handlers played by Franken and Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Al Franken, Tom Davis. And they're putting a...
SNL writers.
SNL writers, of course. Yeah. And they're putting a... this gorilla in a cage onto the train.
Yes.
Because I guess he's being transported to, like, Africa, I believe they're saying, or something like that.
They're vague on it, but yeah. We see the gorilla being loaded onto a ship later, so he's going somewhere overseas.
Right. So I guess, you know, they just put gorillas on the trains with people like that.
Yeah, that's a thing.
That's what they do.
That's a thing.
So that's... It all comes into play.
Belushi, that is a thing. And Belushi's character is he's in a gorilla suit.
Yeah, he's just like some... crazy drunk.
I mean,
dude.
They're both men in gorilla suits, but Belushi's is more obviously a fake gorilla suit.
Yeah. So so they show Beeks getting on the train. Oh, Billy Ray and Lewis, they get the information about where Beeks is going to be, the exact car he's going to be, so they can like do the swap out and get the report. So on the train, Billy Ray, he's dressed as this exchange student from Cameroon. He's put on this big crazy African accent.
Yeah.
Because I guess they all have to be in disguise. And so then Coleman dresses as like an Irish priest.
The drunken Irish priest.
Drunken Irish priest.
Taking swigs from his little...
flask.
The flask. Thank you.
You know, Irish people drink a lot. And they're all playing like stereotypical...
They are. It really is a lot of stereotypes.
Yeah.
And then Ophelia comes in and she's wearing lederhosen, but she's doing a Swedish accent because she doesn't quite know.
Yeah.
And apparently this happened because Jamie Lee Curtis doesn't really do accents. And they were like, well, what accent can you do? And she was like, I could do Swedish. And they were like, yeah, fine. But she's wearing lederhosen.
Whatever.
I mean, in the movie, it's like, yeah, Ophelia doesn't really know the difference. And,
right.
And Coleman is like... But you're wearing lederhosen.
Exactly.
But they just roll with it because she's hot.
Yeah. Just go with it.
Yeah.
You're hot.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So they do their crazy impressions and then they're able to do the swap. I think they
swap out the briefcase.
Yeah. And then but then they go to Aykroyd or Lewis's character who's hiding in the bathroom to give him the papers to swap out.
Yeah.
And then Lewis comes out. Dressed as a Jamaican in blackface for some
Yep.
I was like, is there really a reason for that?
I wonder if this is like, because if this was originally intended for Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, like they had a famous scene in, I think it was Silver Streak,
yeah,
where Gene
yeah.
Wilder's in blackface.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe they were looking to do like a callback to that or something?
Maybe.
I also read on the trivia track at one point it was supposed to be Lewis was going to be in drag, but then they changed it to blackface. I don't remember if that was the original version, or if like it was blackface and then like no, he shouldn't be in black. And apparently the Paramount execs were very nervous about this. They were like, people are going to riot.
You don't say.
Yeah, because apparently blackface was not considered cool in 1983.
What?
Who knew?
but, you know.
Oh, we should give it a little problematic bell there.
Yeah. But, yeah, he...
Actually, let's do a little extra one, because it's blackface.
It is the blackest of blackface. I was shocked, but I was like, whoa.
It is almost Al Jolson blackface.
It is a step away from Amos and Andy.
Yeah.
So anyway, and then they do the swap out, but Beek sees them do the swap out, and
this is like the second swap out.
Yeah, though. Yeah. The second swap out. He didn't see it the first time where they were going to put in the fake.
So I think he was supposed to see the second swap out.
Was he?
I
don't think so.
Well, I don't know.
I don't think
so. Okay, now this is where the point in the ending where we start to get into the weeds, where things get a little harder to understand.
This is the part that gets kind of wacky.
And we will do our best to navigate our way through this.
Yes.
But
yeah, either way, Beek sees the swap out, and of course he knows what they're trying to do, so he pulls a gun on him. He's like, oh, Lewis, and then the jig is up.
Yeah.
The plan falls apart pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And then he takes them to
baggage. I don't understand why, because their disguises were so good.
I know.
Right? They did not attract attention at all.
Ophelia.
They were not culturally offensive in any way.
Ophelia literally shoves her boobs in his face at one point.
Yeah.
That's oof. I mean,
That's
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, 1983, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Hi-yo. So Beekman has a gun on him. He takes him back to baggage where I guess he's going to kill them all.
I guess.
That was
and that's where the gorilla cage is.
Right, that's where the gorilla cage is. So he's like, oh, you know, once I take care of you guys.
We'll... The party's over. And just then, Jim Belushi comes in. He's like, the party's not over.
It's just...
It's 10 p.m. It's not even New Year's yet. Oh, we're going to party.
Yeah, yeah.
And that allows our heroes to get the upper hand on Beeks.
Yeah, cause I think Beeks knocks Belushi's character out. Because like he says, like, get out of here, and he knocks him out with the hammer.
Okay. Yeah.
And then something that happened. And then the gorilla knocks out Beeks.
Right.
Because, you know.
So they put Beeks in the gorilla suit.
Right.
And then they put him in the cage with the gorilla.
Yeah, but they tape his mouth shut so he can't say anything. And
right.
I guess they tape the gorilla costume on him so he can't take it off.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of hazy, but.
It's a little. Just suspend disbelief, guys.
Look, I mean. If we're going to have this guy get raped by a gorilla, you're going to have to go with us. You're going to have to give him a few allowances and suspend your disbelief a little bit. Because otherwise, there's going to be no gorilla raping in this movie. And no one wants that.
Do you not want gorilla rape in this movie?
Come on.
I mean,
if it's a choice between no gorilla rape and gorilla rape, you go with the gorilla rape.
That's just comedy.
That's just a basic rule of cinema.
That's just pure comedy, right?
Oh,
boy. So that happened. I mean, they don't show it, but they imply like he got piped by that gorilla.
Got piped.
Yeah.
And we later see the gorilla cage being shipped off on a boat
to Africa or somewhere,
wherever. Where this gorilla is going for some reason to some rape reserve,
Oh, my God, rape reserve?
Sure, yeah.
Criminy!
Yeah, maybe he's being sent out of the country because the gorilla has a problem with all the raping.
Yeah, that's I did not think about that.
Yeah, and...
So maybe he's going to the
people are like, oh, wait, the manifest says it's only one gorilla. Oh, there are two in there. Yeah. But, oh, they're in love. And then he cuts to a close-up of Beeks's eyes.
Like,
and
womp, womp.
Yeah. It's like, gorilla's forcing itself on him. Yay!
That's
comedy.
That's... The 80s were a wild time. I'm not going to lie to you.
The 80s were a wild time.
A lot of
this ending just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, that part was like, because it does come out of, it's like a whole different movie that it came out. It was like a zany screwball comedy in this.
It feels like it's something from another draft that was drafted on to the end of this movie.
It really does.
I mean, it's a broad movie, but it's not that broad until we get to the gorilla raping.
Yeah, I was like, why is this in here? But I don't know. We just let it go. So anyway. All right. So anyway, so Beeks is in a cage dressed as a gorilla. He can't get out. And, our heroes have the real report, the crops report.
Yes, yes. So they go to the World Trade Center next day to...
Well, actually, before that, they meet up with the Duke's brothers in secret in a underground garage.
Right. It's like a Watergate-esque type meeting.
Very deep throat. So the Duke's give them the money.
They get the report.
They get the fake reports.
Right.
And they had the real reports. And then Billy Ray and Lewis go to New York City. Coleman and... Ophelia also give them their life savings, saying,
right.
Here's all the money I have. Do something with it. Make them pay.
And they're like, don't worry. We got this. We know what we're doing. We've got the inside information. The Duke brothers think they have the inside information.
Right.
And, you know, we're going to come out on top.
Right.
And so the Duke brothers at Wall Street, they instruct their guy on the floor, like, buy all the orange juice shares you can,
because
we want to corner the market.
Right, exactly.
We want to get all this, and I mean, because it's on the trading floor, you can only do this in a limited amount of time, like in between the opening and closing bells.
Right,
and everybody's going frantic.
Yeah, yeah, and they kind of explain a little bit about like the trading floor and everything for, of course, laymen like us.
Right,
I kind of followed along a little bit. I was like, all right,
we vaguely followed. Like, I mean, apparently, this ending has caused confusion over a lot of people who are not in the financial world.
Yeah.
There's actually an article on NPR titled What Actually Happens at the End of Trading Places that explains all this in sort of layman's terms.
Right.
So.
So basically, I mean, after that, there's like a lot of screaming and yelling. and like buy, buy, sell, sell, blogger, blogger.
Because the Duke brothers are buying the Orange Juice futures so aggressively, it drives up the price of this.
Yeah, and then people see them buying. It's like, oh, they must know something. Let's get on that.
Right, and so then Aykroyd and Murphy start selling their shares.
Right.
At 142, it says here. So they're okay. So on the NPR article, it says here's what that means. He wants to promise to sell orange juice in April for 142 per pound. The 30 in his line means he wants to start by selling 30 contracts. Also, one contract equals many, many pounds of OJ. So they're selling at this inflated price.
Right.
And then the orange juice report comes in. The real report.
Right.
Talking about how the brutal winter weather has affected this year's orange crop, which of course will affect the price.
Okay.
So this guy comes on and the Secretary of Agriculture comes on the TV and he says, orange crop is fine, the winter didn't affect it, so it's all good. So now everybody's bought at this inflated price.
Okay.
So now I've lost track. So now the price starts falling.
Right.
Because of this report, like, there's going to be no shortage of orange juice.
Right. And the Duke brothers, like, realize what happened.
Right. And they try to get on the floor and desperately stop their guy.
But it's too late.
It's too late.
The guy, like, fainted or something.
Yeah, well, they you're supposed to buy low, sell high. And that is what Aykroyd and Murray did. The Duke brothers, they bought high. Sorry.
That's right.
Force of Habit, because the Aykroyd and Bill Murray have done so many movies together.
Oh.
Aykroyd and Murphy, so they bought high and they've like sold out their stock, I believe, and so they've got all this money for the high price, but the Duke brothers, they bought all this at that inflated price, and then the end of trading, they owe, I don't know how many thousand
it was over 3 million, I believe. Something, it was like crazy money.
It was I think it was like 300 million.
300 million, right.
Yeah, and they're like, we can't cover that, and you have to cover this in cash, apparently. So then they're like, okay, well, we will take your seats on the floor, and we will seize all your assets and all your stuff, and they are ruined.
Yeah.
The Duke brothers are ruined.
Yeah, so you see, like, Randolph has a heart attack over this, like, oh my God, and he has a heart attack, and then... Like, he falls to floor, Mortimer is, like, screaming at somebody. Right. And
yeah, they're like, your brother just had a heart attack. And Mortimer literally goes, fuck him. This is a fun story. Is Don Ameche, very old school Hollywood actor, he when he read the script, he was like, I don't think I can say that word.
Really?
Yeah. And John Landis was like, well, I'm afraid you would have to say that word if... you're going to take this part. That's like a deal breaker.
It's a non-negotiable.
Right. I mean, because he just realized, like, you need that F-bomb in there.
I mean, it works.
And
like, you can't say, like, to hell or to heck with him.
No. You need that F-bomb.
Yeah.
You got to choose them judiciously. And John Landis knew he needed an F-bomb there.
No one to hold him.
So Don Ameche, he said, like, okay. He agreed to do it. He announced, like, on the floor, they were shooting this on the actual trading floor, like, on the weekend.
Oh.
And they also mixed it in with, like, some real footage of real trading that they shot.
Okay.
And Don Ameche said, okay, I'm going to say this word. I'm just going to do this once.
Wow, and
He really...
He's old school.
Yeah.
I kind of appreciate that.
I admire that.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that he has those convictions. I like that he was also flexible enough to recognize, like, oh, well, this is a good part. This was his first movie in, like, 13 years.
Wow.
And, you know, I think he was still working. He was doing, like, TV and stuff like that. And then a couple years later, he wins an Oscar for Cocoon. For Best Supporting Actor.
That's
so
right.
This was really like the start of Don Ameche's big comeback.
I remember that.
Which, great story. But yeah, he just did like one take of that and he was like, that's it, we are done.
That's weird that he was troubling. He had a hard time saying that, but he was okay with saying the N word. Think about that.
I am thinking about that. That doesn't say
No, I just
it doesn't say anything good.
It just occurred to me.
Like, I don't know if he raised a protest about that, or maybe he had a similar distaste. I only read the story like, about the F-bomb.
It just occurred to me, like, hey, he said the N-bomb, but he's had problems saying fuck.
I
but whatever.
Darren, I don't have any sort of answer for you there. All I can do is...
I'm not here to slander the man's name. A little
problematic, Bell, but... That is a thought. That is an excellent point.
So basically the Duke brothers are ruined.
Yeah.
They're no money. And then we cut to Billy Ray with some woman and Coleman with some woman. On a tropical island.
Yeah.
And it seems like Coleman has a butler now because he's telling somebody to get him some, you know,
lobster. I mean, Coleman's set for life because, like, he put in his life savings. Right. So they made enough money for everyone to be... Right. Well off for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and Lewis and Ophelia are together. They're on a boat. And
They're on a yacht. Like a nice sailboat, schooner. I don't know about boats.
Right.
But 1983, nice Jamie Lee Curtis in a white bikini. I'm just putting that out there. Bill Murray in a lovely Cosby sweater.
Cool. Eddie Murphy, what are you talking about?
God damn it.
Wow, you can't
get... What the hell, man?
You got Murray on the mind.
I do. We were talking about possible future movies we could do in the next couple weeks.
Yeah.
Bill Murray's name came up.
It did.
And Eddie Murphy in a lovely Cosby sweater.
I was saying, like, why are you wearing a Cosby sweater in the tropics? That's like...
That it's a weird choice. Yes,
it's an odd.
Like, I mean, it's a lovely sweater. Don't get me wrong.
Maybe it breathes easy. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's a cotton.
Yeah, cotton
a nice,
blend.
A nice cotton, nice breathable fabric. Cotton. I don't know.
But yeah, so our heroes are on top, and they're set for life.
And
the movie.
And the Duke brothers are ruined and destitute. Yeah.
But then they make an appearance in another movie.
Another John Landis, Eddie Murphy collaboration.
A little thing called Coming to America.
Yeah, so a movie they did in, I think it was 1988?
I want to say 87.
Okay.
87, 88. I should know something. I'm pretty sure it's 87.
But there's a cute thing where Eddie Murphy's character, Azeem,
Prince Akeem.
Akeem, okay.
He's walking with Lisa, you know, and they're on a date, and they're walking through a park, and then he sees two homeless men on the streets in New York, and he gives them a ton of money.
Right.
Like, he just has, because it was the money he took from Semi, played by Arsenio Hall, so he wouldn't, like, you know, cause mischief or whatever.
You remember this well.
It's one of my favorite movies. I watched this many times.
Okay.
So he gives these two homeless men, you know, a ton of money, you know, just to do it, and then they show that those two homeless men are Mortimer and Randolph from the movie Trading Places.
And it's Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche.
Yeah.
And they go like, Mortimer, we're back.
Yeah.
And
I didn't get that reference because when I saw it, I saw it before I saw Trading Places.
Yeah.
But now I saw Trading Places. I'm like, oh, all right. Those are the guys from the thing.
Put it together. Yeah.
Look at that. All in the John Landis universe.
That's right. So it's
the JLU,
the John Landis cinematic universe.
Yeah, JLCU, JCU.
So there are two people who look exactly like Eddie Murphy running around in this universe.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to suspend this belief a little bit.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the movie, and what a movie! It's a great movie. It holds up.
It still has a lot of laughs.
Yeah.
A lot of.
I dug it, man.
Yeah, it's funny. It's entertaining. There are a couple moments where you're just like, but
there are a couple, yeah.
But like, I think you're going to get that in most any movie made in 1983.
Yeah,
just because the culture has, I don't know if I want to say evolved, but it's moved on.
We've gotten a little bit better.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
We are marginally better. We are
marginally.
Yeah.
And so that's a movie. I'm just trying to see if anybody. You know, tweeted us anything. Mike Segroy, when we mentioned that we were doing this, tweeted us, it's beef jerky time, which is something that, like, Eddie Murphy, as a Cameroon student, was like, he was all about beef jerky for some reason.
Yeah, yeah.
And, that seems to be it.
So.
But, yeah, I dug this movie quite a bit. Still holds up. I guess the SNL nerds, a thumbs up of approval.
That's true. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure when they... release this on DVD again, there will be a little circle with our pictures on it, with us both going thumbs up.
All right, so
I will not be in blackface in that photo, just because that's not a good look.
Please don't.
No
as your friend, I'm gonna say please.
I will say right now, I am 96% certain I'm not going to be in blackface in that photo.
I like those odds.
let's see if there's any more trivia about the movie. The baggage handlers were supposed to be Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas from SCT.
Oh.
They were going to be the McKenzie brothers.
Ooh.
But that fell through. So Dan Aykroyd recommended Tom Davis and Al Franken for the parts because he was friends with them from their time on SNL.
I can see Moranis and Thomas doing that too.
And this is interesting. When Al Franken was elected to Congress, he had to, of course, disclose his finances.
Right.
And apparently, as of 2012, he was still getting some residuals from this movie.
Really?
So I don't know if it was a lot, but it doesn't give the amount. But
getting that long money.
But that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, you go.
So, yeah.
Yeah, not bad. Not too shabby.
Not too shabby.
Great. Trading Places. Great film.
Trading Places, yes.
All right, should we tell the good people what the next movie is going to be about?
Yeah, we talked about this before we start taping. We think we've come to a conclusion.
We've given us a lot of thought.
Yeah.
We've weighed facts and figures, did a lot of charts.
Did the calculation.
Crunch the numbers.
Yeah.
Pie charts, the whole Magilla.
Yep.
And we come out with one of my favorite movies. I mean, I don't know.
A movie with some very heavy SNL connections. It's got two cast members, a frequent host, and produced by Mr. Lorne Michaels.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing Three Amigos.
Yes.
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 It's one of my favorite movies. It's a movie that comes on like Channel 11 all the time. I'd always watch it. I mean, I remember quoting it all the time. I got it. I'm sure I have it.
By the way, do you remember who directed Three Amigos?
No.
John Landis.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. We are just this is just gradually becoming a John Landis podcast.
It is.
It's I'd forgotten, but I was like I just had a moment I was like, "Wait, was this directed by like yes, it was."
Wow. This is the summer of John Landis.
It really is. It really is. We're going through John Landis's whole cinematic oeuvre.
Yes.
Yes. So
we tip our hat to you, Mr. John Landis. If you ever want to be a guest on this podcast, by all means,
you are welcome to come by anytime, sir.
Tweet at us at SNL Nerds Show.
Yes,
whenever you want.
That's right.
We'll leave the light on for you.
But we're looking forward to this. I haven't seen Three Amigos in I don't know how long. It's been at least a decade.
It's been a minute, but I'm pretty sure I remember all of it.
I have strong memories of it. So yeah, this will be fun. I'm looking forward to this. So
let's ride.
All right.
Right away on the women.
Also, you can check us both out on some other podcasts. We were both some other podcasts that both dropped this week. I was on another episode of Cheers Cast with my friend Ryan Daly.
Yeah, it's a podcast all about Cheers.
All about Cheers, going through Cheers episode by episode. Ooh. I talked about the season 2 episode Sumner's Return, where the guy who dumps Diane Chambers in the pilot comes back to Cheers.
Oh, I don't know if I remember that.
And hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue. Go check it out, guys.
Yeah.
And you can listen to me. I was on the Decomposition podcast. I was in their live episode, taped in front of a live studio audience.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the hit blockbuster song. What was it?
Call Me Maybe.
Call Me Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. By Carly Rae Jepsen.
Carly Rae Jepsen. And that was just a hoot and a half.
I was there that night.
Yeah, you were there that night.
I wasn't on the air or anything, but I was there. I was hanging out with. With the Decomposition folk.
Yeah, Brad and Katie, of course, former guests on our podcast. Natty Bumpercar was there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Donna V.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle Traina.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were all there. So check it out. Yep. It's a hoot and a half. I was kind of drunk, so fun times ensued.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's our podcast. If you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Darren Credible, Darin Credible. I got a show coming up on Wednesday the 11th, Star Bar in Bushwick, Brooklyn, if you want to come out and check that out.
Cool.
All the info is on my website, DarrenCredible.com.
And you can follow me at Trumbull Comic on Twitter. And you can also follow the show Twitter at SNL Nerds Show. And we also have a Facebook page that's just SNL Nerds.
Yeah.
You can also follow the other podcasts from the Non-Productive Network at non-productive.com. Contribute to our Patreon.
Yeah.
And rate and review us on the iTunes, the Apple Podcasts, and all that. We love hearing the feedback. Come at us. Let us know what you think of the show. Let us know what you'd like us to do on the show.
Yeah.
We got, after Three Amigos, we'll have one more week before the season 45 premiere. We're open to suggestions on what to do on that.
Yeah, please. So, give us some suggestions. Give us some reviews. It's been a while since we've gotten reviews.
So. It has been. It's been since like July. So we are hungry for more affirmation.
Yes. So, starved for attention.
Yes. We are very emotionally fragile. So,
gimme.
So let us know what's going on
there.
Yes,
we're emotionally draining.
All right. But that is it for this week. So until next week, nerds out.
Yeah, nerds out.
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.